Caught Offside with Andrew Gundling and JJ Devaney.
Oh, yes. Caught Offside from a basement in Westchester and an apartment in Brooklyn. Andrew Gundling and JJ Devaney. What's up, brother?
Hey, man. How are you? It's great to hear and see you.
Yeah, I know. We're kind of seeing each other through the magic of technology. I don't want to trick people into thinking that we're back in studio. This is all through the wonder of the internet.
And we're also very responsible in terms of our social distancing.
Yeah. You know, I was thinking about that after we signed off on the last podcast and like how we were talking about like the seriousness. And I think everyone does get that. But do you wonder at all? Because you and I, in some ways, are in kind of like a bubble within New York, where New York has kind of become like the epicenter of this pandemic within the United States. And so after, when we were done, like I sometimes forget, like this podcast goes to people all over the country or all over the world or wherever. Not everybody's from New York, hardly, who listen to this show. So like I sometimes wonder if everyone quite like is seeing this through this, the kind of eyes that you and I are seeing it through, like the serious nature of it.
I don't think so. I think they understand the serious nature of it, but I think that the social distancing part is so easy to them that they are not actively having to think about it in the same way that New Yorkers or people in Boston or people in built up parts of New Jersey are. I spoke to my mom and dad in rural Ireland today in the west of Ireland in County Sligo, and for them it's, it's not nice not to be able to be close to your neighbors, but they are in the middle of nowhere. We had a listener contact us just as this thing was really culminating and coming together, and it was St. Patrick's Day, and I think he was in Idaho, and he was in his front room with a whiskey, dressed like he was from The Quiet Man, and he was having a St. Patrick's Day party on his own, listening to records and waiting for the pod to drop, because you know it's easy to self-isolate in certain parts of the country. But it's very strange times, and this pod, like I've been really looking forward to doing this today, because sometimes your mind drifts away, and because you don't see, apart from the quiet streets, you don't really see outward signs of what's going on right now. But I'm very conscious that like 500 meters away, New York Presbyterian Hospital is right beside me, and in there, it must be incredible and incredibly tough and taxing on the people who have got to go to work there and are on the front line of this. So as excited as I am to do this podcast, you know, it's weird. I'm almost admonishing myself for being excited in these circumstances. But
yeah, I know. That's a good point. And we're going to actually kind of talk about almost that subject in particular, because there have been some developments in terms of the Premier League and when or if we could see more action from that league in the not so distant future. So we're going to talk about that. We've got a red card man of the match. I'm truly excited about my man of the match tonight. I might even tease it now so you and our listeners can start thinking about it. Your all-time U.S. men's team.
Oh, wow.
I'm just going to throw that out there, and I'm going to walk away slowly, and you can all think about it. So that'll be fun. And then kind of along those lines, JJ, we've got our first time machine emergency podcast tonight.
I've been working on the time machine. It's going to take us back 10 years to 2009.
That would be 11, but close.
Sorry. Over a decade. Sorry. Oh, my God. Oh, counting. Counting, you are not my friend. Well, we're going to go back to Bloemfontein in 2009 to the Confederations Cup. And a game that sent, I would say it sent shockwaves around the world. At the time. And we'll talk a bit more about it when we get to it, but it was a major upset and one of the most famous wins in the history of the U.S. men's national team. And I know you're going to enjoy that one. Hopefully the time machine works and it doesn't send us back to, you know, way too far back. Like we end up at the Battle of Monmouth.
Nobody knows that. Although I've always been, if you could go back to any time in history, do you have one in particular?
I think I've said before, and it's particularly grim, but it's an area of interest. World War II. I'd like to either be in Berlin or in London in the middle of it, just to see what life was like at the time. London, obviously, during the Blitz would be fascinating. But I think also Berlin during that period of time would have been so weird and fascinating to me.
I feel like revolutionary times within the United States, not even the Revolutionary War, but like, wouldn't it be cool to just like be dropped into like 1770 New York City and just see like, just walk through the streets of New York and just see what it was like, or Philly or Boston? Like, I think it would be just such a cool, cool time to be a part of.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, me and you could rant about history for a long, long time. All I just thought while you were speaking there was of your chunky legs in those silk socks they used to wear. And the puffy pants and the buckle shoes.
I would own every part of it. Powdered wig, all of it. This might be my Halloween costume this year.
Yeah. And of course, you know, we do regular reads for Four Hymns. It's fourpowderedwigs.com back in the day.
Yeah. Don't lose your hair. You can get a powdered wig to fix that.
Exactly.
Let's start now, JJ. There's been a lot of news over the past week pertaining to the coronavirus and when football could be played again. I guess we'll just start with this. There was a report in The Independent basically describing plans that had been thrown around with how the Premier League could resume, where they essentially, for lack of a better term, they just kind of create their own EPL bubble in the Midlands of England. They find, you know, they put players through a coronavirus test to make sure that everyone participating is going to be healthy. And they kind of just like almost lock them away in this world unto itself and then finish out the season within this EPL bubble. No fans, just the bare bones of it. Players, you know, the training staff, coaches, and then whatever TV personnel would be necessary to make this happen. And that's kind of where we're at.
Yeah. So it would be like essentially over June and July, the remaining 92 games would be run off. There would be multiple games per day. They're talking about venues and sites. And if fans aren't going to be there, which in the discussions that were talked about in this Independent article, there would be no fans. So they're looking at sites even possibly, although not confirmed, St. George's Park, which is basically the English training, football training center, which would have multiple fields and pitches that they could play on. That appears to be the major idea right now, if normality can't be returned to before then.
So this is an interesting one. So in terms of, because a lot of people, you know, when this subject gets thrown around, you get asked, what do you think of this? I went on Twitter and I kind of, the initial reactions seemed to be a little bit of just like blind hate. You know, people don't like new ideas necessarily. And this is as outside the box idea as you can really come up with. And I just kind of want to say initially, I'm not really here for that. Like the blind hate right now. I have said for weeks on this show that like we're in a moment here where to me there are no bad ideas other than the let's void the season idea. That's the only idea that I'm not here for. But I'm here for everything else though. So like ultimately I think people are skeptical of it because we all know what this is. This is a TV money play.
Yeah.
And I think that sickens a lot of people.
Definitely.
To see what, you know, because we're so hyper aware of the fact that soccer and major sports all over the country have become kind of slaves to the TV industry. So I understand why people would see this and kind of be skeptical of it. But like, if that's your primary reason, you know, because Sky Sports is going to make money off of this, I just don't think that's a legitimate enough reason for me. Like, okay, you're not going to get the ending of the season that you wanted. It's as simple as that, no matter what happens. So like, if you're somebody who's kind of starving for soccer action to take place and somebody who wants some kind of resolution to the season, if we can operate under the assumption that the players will be safe taking part in this, that everyone who is a part of this will test positive and we can move forward knowing that that is the reality of the situation. I don't know. If your only reason is I don't want to see Sky Sports benefit, like to what end then? Like, there's people out there who want to see soccer and who want to see a result to the season. So if this is the best way to do it, that's not enough of a reason to not do it for me.
I think, Andrew, I agree with you in part. I think the idea that, you know, Sky Sports benefit, well, you know, NBC, SN benefits, I get that. I understand that. But they're going to benefit anyway. I think my issue would be, that I was reading Gabriel Mercati yesterday, and
he was very good on this. A couple of things I wanted to mention.
He was very good on it, and he got me thinking. On the face of it, Andrew, as a way of in this recalibrated expectations of how the season will end, in this new world that we're operating in, this is something that could work. This is an idea. So on the basic idea level, I like it. But I do think that, as Gabriel points out in his piece, this solves nothing down the football pyramid.
Right.
This, you know, what happens in the Championship, League One or League Two? The Premier League, like, doesn't rely on gate receipts, but some clubs are week to week in League One and in League Two, and probably the lower end of the Championship, and they rely on gate receipts. They can't do this idea. How will they do it? Like, it's such top up thinking. It just solves a problem for the Premier League. And this is the other point that Gab makes, and I know you've touched on it here, but I do think it's important because, like you said, we have become slaves to the idea of TV money, and that this is a TV game, and that this is entertainment, and the match day fan has largely been forgotten about. This is what Gab says. To some traditionalists for whom match-going fans are some kind of exalted class, that's an anathema, the idea that was pointed out about doing this behind closed doors. They'll point out that football has already bent over every which way, mostly backwards and over, to accommodate broadcasters and sponsors. Any solution that excludes supporters is not a solution, they'll say. I get their point, but the reality is that when it comes to the elite competitions, that ship sailed a long time ago. The reality is that at the highest levels, match-going fans matter less and less to the bottom line. These are global brands who deliver their product around the world. All that would change to most observers in the scenario set out by the Premier League for June and July is, instead of a teeming Anfield, we'll get a training ground pitch, or maybe, if we're looking, some digitized version of Anfield. And that, to me, was the point that really Gab hammered home. The game is just, especially at that level, whether I like it or not, and I don't like it, this is beyond, you know, the ship has sailed on TV. TV is now the be all and end all. And those clubs in the Premier League do not want to hand back potentially billions.
No.
Which they would have to do in the event that the season is stopped or voided.
I guess my question to people would be, like what you mentioned there from what Gab wrote, is that, you know, how uncomfortable a watch it's going to be with no atmosphere. Like, this sport, more than any other sport that I follow, and I follow all of them, this sport is reliant on atmosphere.
Yeah.
So it will feel, the thought of Leicester celebrating, clinching top four in on a training field, the thought of Liverpool winning their first title in decades on a training field, yes, it's bizarre, but I don't know what the more appealing option is. Unless people are willing to wait, and we have no idea how long that'll be, 6 months, 8 months, 12 months, 14, like, I don't know. None of us know, and no one can act like they know. So that's the only other option. If people are just willing to wait, okay, fine, but then what? Like, how willing are you to see the calendar for this sport get screwed up in a year we're coming up on a European Championship in 2021 and then a World Cup in 2022? Like, how off can the calendar really become?
Well, I would make this point on the calendar. It makes no sense to me to void an 8 month, a season that's gone through 8 months, three quarters of its season. And if a season has to struggle, it should be next season. The ideal scenario is that we push this thing as far as we possibly can, get crowds back into the grounds. And if that means finishing it in October, November, December of this year, so be it. Figure, maybe void the season that hasn't happened. Figure out how we work in the international tournaments in that summer, and then reset for the 2022-2023 season.
That's a fair point.
The 2021-2022 season.
Right. No, that's right. Like, I also subscribe to that idea of you must finish what you have started.
Oh.
Especially, like you just said, like, it's not MLS. Like, I should couch this by saying that doesn't apply to MLS. They play two games. Okay, like, no one's going to feel bad if MLS voids this season and starts over next year. Nothing has been decided. But, like, the Premier League, things are, like, Liverpool have won this title. You cannot void that. It means too much. It's too important to the fans of that club that have spent their lives rooting for them, to that city. It just means we're too far along here. You can't void it. There's got to be a better way. And I'm here for all of them. Now, the one thing that you didn't mention that was also in Gab's column about this that I that I also agree with. For a lot of these guys, like we're talking about young guys, who haven't necessarily experienced a ton on like a global scale like this in their lives. I mean, you know, you and I are in our mid thirties. I don't know if we've ever experienced anything quite like this. This is the most stressful time period in a lot of people's lives. So the thought of removing someone from their wife and kids for 2 months, I don't know if every player is going to be cool with that. I don't know.
I don't think so either. And also, again, we're speculating on how far along the virus is and in terms of its contagion around the United Kingdom come June or July. Now, it was Miguel Delaney that wrote the piece for The Independent and who got the inside track on these discussions. And Miguel makes the point, in June or July, will it be morally or ethically right to take doctors and nurses? Because you're going to need doctors, physios, nurses, EMTs at these games, mm-hmm. right? So is it going to be morally appropriate to do that, to take them away from places where they're needed? And secondly, Andrew, a really just basic point that Miguel brought up in his piece was, what does one do or where does one send the player that gets injured, that invariably someone's going to tear a hamstring, it's going to require immediate attention. Where does one send the ACL sufferer? God forbid someone is knocked unconscious or something like that. We are the Premier League and the other leagues that will try to finish their seasons too, albeit behind closed doors, will be sending their players to hospitals that could be already in serious trouble in June and July. There's a whole ethical thing about that too.
You're right. Logistical nightmare. I don't know how, you're right. There is, that's why I guess I say I'm here for all the ideas, because there is not going to be a perfect idea. So I think we have to approach all of them with an open mind. I don't know what I could suggest that's better than this, than that's better than waiting, like you suggested, and then just voiding the following season.
Yeah.
I don't know. This is so uncharted territory that like there is no expert here. There is nobody who has like the right idea.
No, we're all just putting out ideas. And the thing about this podcast being on a Wednesday night is I fear that the Premier League will have some kind of skeletal plan at least by Thursday or Friday.
Why do you think that?
Because that's what the reports are saying. There's another conversation going to happen, I think, tomorrow morning. And amongst all the clubs in the Premier League. So they may have something more concrete by the end of the week. And of course, they'll gazump this podcast because they show us zero respect.
It's just weird that they would do that now. Like, how can...
They've got time. They should actually wait. But we don't know what pressure's been put on them from TV companies to get something solid on paper. We don't know that.
Boy, I hope... Yeah, you're right. I mean... Money will talk when it's all said and done. There's just too much of it that's at stake. But yeah, I have no idea.
There's some scary things though, Andrew. In the Football League, there's 45 clubs. This was mentioned in an article I read during the week. There's 45 clubs potentially that could go to business over this period, if depending on how long it goes on for, because again, match day receipts, match day income is absolutely everything to them. And we should not get fixated on the Premier League alone. This has knock-on effects. Football is a pyramid and, unfortunately, it doesn't appear as if trickle-down economics are something that works into the English football pyramid.
Yeah, so reportedly there were 4 clubs in the Premier League that were willing to have this season voided.
There was 2 initially, and of course, Karen Brady decided to voice her opinion on this for money in the Sun newspaper. And we didn't know, I'm not sure if we knew who the other club was. And now apparently, according to Miguel Delaney in The Independent, there's 4. But they are obviously in the minority, and I think this is a vista that the Premier League want to avoid at all costs, and I can understand.
Yeah, I mean, if I had to guess, like, if West Ham is one of them, I mean, are we just, is it as simple as Bournemouth, Norwich?
Oh, Robert, yeah.
Like, just look at them. And I will say this, in fairness to them, it's very easy for us to sit here and rip Karen Brady because we all know her motives when she says that. Hmm. But like, imagine if this was put to a vote, imagine being Norwich, like the chairman at Norwich, and having to say, yes, well, I want this season to count. Like,
I don't want to jump in and defend Norwich when I don't know what they did say.
I'm just throwing them out as an example because they're bottom of the table.
But Norwich do seem like a club. They seem like they're in the kind of, in the zone of the boing boing baggies. They seem like a fairly well-run club that can absorb or at least have accepted their role in the football world, that there is a more likely than not they're going to be relegated at some point and they'll be back up again. They seem, I don't know, there's something about the way the club is run, from the manager to the players that they sign.
I'm only throwing their name out there as an example, as just like random bottom three club. Like, I'm just saying, imagine being a team that is going to get relegated. And like all of a sudden you've been thrown into this moment where you actually might have a say in nullifying that and like wiping it from the record like a mulligan. And like imagine having to face your fan base and your players and say, no, I did in fact vote for us to be relegated. Like, we can mock Karen Brady because stuff like that seems so insignificant in a time like this, but eventually they are going to start playing again and there will be players and fans once they get back on the pitch. It'll be like, really? Like our own people from within couldn't have cast the vote to allow us like the mulligan here and to stay in the league for another year. So like all I'm saying is I get it. I get why somebody in the bottom three would think hard about that vote.
Cynicism and total self-interest. Yes.
Yes. You've hit on it. Exactly right. Self-interest trumps all. You had also mentioned that what had happened the past few days in Barcelona has been of great interest to you and many.
Yeah, so the players have agreed to take a 70% pay cut, while Messi also announced on social media that the players would make an added contribution to ensure that none of the non-playing staff at Barcelona would have to take a wage reduction. And so when I first read the articles about this, I thought, oh, okay, that's really good from Lionel Messi. But I hadn't read... I don't speak Spanish. I had not read his Instagram post. So yeah. I went over to Marca, Andrew. And of course, Marca translated it and they gave me the real context for this. Messi's statement, it just doesn't appear to take a swipe at the administration at Barcelona. It does take a swipe. This is the translation that Marca printed. Before anything, this is Lionel Messi. Before anything, we want to clarify that our will has always been to take a pay cut, because we understand perfectly that this is an exceptional situation and we're always the first ones that have helped the club when we've been asked. We've done it sometimes off our own back when we thought it was necessary or important in other times. Therefore, it doesn't surprise us that the club wanted to put us back under the microscope and try to pressure us into doing something we were always going to do. And there's just this building, like, I don't know if it's a building... tension or...
No, that is what it is.
No, it's more than tension. It's Messi flexing his muscle. And I wouldn't argue with it in this scenario. But if we look back earlier in the year, in January, to the Eric Abidal incidents, the whole controversy surrounding that, and Messi was vocal again on social media, and he is not afraid to take this board on at all.
Well, his power is such, like, there are very few players that can flex the kind of muscle that he is able to flex. And I think at a lot of clubs that would fly, but Barcelona is one of those clubs where I just don't think that flies. Like, it's such a politically strong club. And this idea of the board versus the player, I think, is one that's caused a lot of stress and tension there for quite some time. Like, I was reading a little bit about this because I must kind of admit that I was not super aware until the Abidal incident of like this tension that there seemed to be between the board, between Messi and players, Bartomeu and Messi specifically. So I was reading at goal.com. I think Mark Doyle wrote an article kind of doing a bit of a deep dive on this tension. And it's very interesting. This kind of, I guess the new phase of this began around the time that Barcelona allowed Neymar to leave, when it was a thing that the players did not want. And the players were skeptical of the fact that the board were saying one thing and doing another. Essentially, the player, Messi, they were skeptical that Bartomeu wanted Neymar out, but was lying publicly, saying that we're trying to keep him, but almost putting it as though it was not their fault, that this was a Neymar thing, when in fact it was more of a Barcelona thing. Then fast forward to earlier this year, I'm reading now, Cadena SER, which is a premier Spanish radio network, claimed in February that Barca had hired a public relations company to, quote, protect Bartomeu's reputation via social media accounts and, quote, erode the image of his enemies, including former players, election candidates, and even Messi. Bartomeu acknowledged that Barcelona had indeed employed 13 Ventures, which was the company that was doing this through social media. They were tied to one of the social media accounts mentioned in the expose to, quote, monitor different areas of the club online. But Bartomeu insisted that the allegations that the company had been hired to discredit anyone were totally false. He then immediately turned around and severed all ties with this company, which is kind of the behavior of somebody who's maybe guilty in what these allegations are. There is a weird tension between Messi, Bartomeu. I think now it's become abundantly public with Messi making these comments. And I don't quite understand, like, what's in it for Bartomeu to have some sort of public feud with Messi? Like, when is he winning that battle?
There's nothing to be won from that. I know Barcelona, or I believe Barcelona have a presidential election coming up soon, correct?
I actually don't know.
Yeah.
I'll defer to you on that.
I think that they do. And maybe this is some kind of power play towards that, Andrew.
Well, what, is Messi running?
Well, no, but in terms of, look at me, I'm the one, you know, I'm the guy who, I do everything for the club. The club comes first. I don't care what player I'm against or, you know, who's coming up against me. It's next year the presidential election is, actually.
But here's what I don't understand pertaining to this situation. If the players, and Bartomeu himself admits that he did know all along that the players were willing to take a significant pay cut. And he's saying he doesn't know who leaked this version of the story. But like, if that's what the players were always intending to do, why leak this story? What is in it for Barcelona's board or whoever to vilify the team and make the players look bad?
But also to upset Messi, who clearly is such a kingmaker in the club. It makes no sense. It really doesn't.
Unless they think that he has gotten too powerful.
Well, that's the other side. Like what I was alluding to, it's like a power play that there's a strong man that needs to emerge in Barcelona to wrench the club away from this uppity player. Problem is with this uppity player, he's the greatest player they've ever had.
Right. Like, I sometimes wonder, you would know about this. I mean, you've been here in the States through like LeBron's rise to what he is. And like, I sometimes wondered, you know, it's a little different because Messi could leave Barcelona. And I do feel like Barcelona is in such a place that they may not be as good, but they will continue to still be one of the great clubs in the world. But like, I sometimes wondered when LeBron was in Cleveland and like his power had risen to a point, he's making moves. Like he's signing Tristan Thompson to like a max contract for, cause he likes the guy and wants him on the team when he's a player that's never worth it.
And I wonder,
like, sometimes these players become too powerful and you wonder what the guys in the front office sometimes think. Like, as great as LeBron was, I couldn't help but wonder if there were guys in that front office that were like, phew, like now we can like do our jobs.
I think it's a double-edged sword. You want the success that LeBron brings, but you also don't want to see LeBron emasculating a coach on the court, like we saw in a playoff game for Cleveland. What was the name of the coach? He coached in Israel for a while.
David Blatt.
Blatt.
Yeah.
I mean, look at what he did to Blatt.
He had no respect for him, and he made it clear to anyone watching. Now, it's not a perfect, there are no perfect analogies, and this is certainly imperfect because the Cavs would obviously love LeBron to still be there. They became one of the worst teams in the league after he left. But I'm just saying, like, in comparison to Messi, maybe his power has reached those kind of levels where, like, maybe there are signings Barcelona wants to make and he's just like not on board. And so these things aren't allowed to happen under his watch. I don't know.
Well, maybe they need to, maybe if you're a candidate or you're being challenged or you will be challenged for your candidacy as president, you need to go into next year with your player who's approaching his mid 30s under control and that you have this sense of power. I don't know. You know what? Maybe we'll try and get Graham Hunter on this one because we need the deep dive of Graham to come.
Oh, it'll be deep.
It will be a deep cut from Graham to try and understand all this.
Yeah. Before we move off of some of this, the coronavirus section of tonight's podcast, there were a couple other things that we wanted to mention. Pepe Reina.
Before we get off the Messi thing. Sorry.
Oh my God.
Did you see what L'Equipe did for Messi's stance, for him coming out on social media?
I have the picture right here, actually.
Yeah. So, for anyone who can't see, L'Equipe mocked up the infamous, or the famous, depending on how you look at it, poster of Che Guevara. And they put Messi there with the flowing hair and the beret. And it said, Lionel Messi, le Che du Barça. So Lionel Messi, the Che Guevara of Barça. Interestingly, Andrew, Che Guevara was born in Rosario in Argentina, as was Lionel Messi.
Oh, wow. What you've done there just blew my mind. That's fantastic.
Now, I am not comparing the one of, I mean, let's be honest. Che Guevara was, he had a terrible first touch. He couldn't control the ball. He loved the left wing too much.
Wow.
Far too much. And he never made it onto the Forbes top 10 richest players.
Top 10. I believe Messi's number one.
Oh, he is? Yeah.
I think he's number one.
Which is an interesting contrast with dear old Che, who Che Guevara would not have believed in a lot of the hyper-capitalism of the modern game.
No, probably not. A couple other coronavirus soccer-related items that we did want to mention. Pepe Reina spoke out about his battle with this virus, and
we're going to get to that though later.
We're
going to get to that later. It's a tale of two Aston Villa players for my red card and man of the match.
I see.
But Pepe did get it.
Yeah,
and we'll talk about that later.
Yeah, and then we also wanted to express condolences for Papa Diouf, former president of Marseille. 68 years old. He was also a journalist. He was also an agent, and then ultimately became the president of the club. I believe it was the club that he kind of grew up supporting. He moved to France at a fairly young age, to Marseille. Just kind of, you know, for anyone out there, I guess, who kind of continues to have a hard time grappling with the realness of this, you know, it's, for soccer fans, it was one of those things that you see that it causes it to hit home once more.
Yeah, he was the first black president of a top flight club in any of Europe's top six leagues, which was an incredible thing. And I think he was at the helm. He appointed Didier Deschamps to the job. And I believe he was at the helm when they won their first title in 20 years or something like that. So, look, 68, it's no age. It's really quite scary.
Yeah, so former Liverpool and France striker Djibril Cissé spoke about it. He said, "Today, French football lost a great man. I always remember our discussion a month before I got signed at Olympique Marseille, and even more the ones we had after my injury." And then he kind of goes into just the nature of his relationship with Diouf. It's awful, man. This has just been terrible. Continuing to watch the news every day and just seeing more and more bad news, which is why we're here, right? This is a distraction. So let's actually do some soccer talk. This won't be a distraction, such a welcome distraction for me, because this is the portion of the show where you want to just rip Tottenham for the next 10 minutes or so.
Well, unfortunately, it wasn't the plan, Andrew, but these things have just just come in front of me. So what do you want to do first? Do you want to deal with Tottenham under fire, or do you want to talk about
a
want-away player?
No, let's not do Harry Kane just yet.
Okay.
Because I guess it's kind of still on topic. I'm guessing you want to get into Tottenham and what they have announced is going to be happening with their staff.
Yeah. So this was reported by Dan Roan of the BBC yesterday under the headline, "Coronavirus, Tottenham's non-playing staff are to take a pay cut." And so Dan basically gives the bullet points of what's going to happen here. So Spurs say 550 non-playing staff will take a 20% pay cut for the next 2 months, and they'll use the government's furlough job retention scheme in an attempt to protect jobs. The net worth of Spurs owner Joe Lewis, Andrew, is £4.3 billion sterling. Yep. The pay of chairman Daniel Levy is £7 million. and the average player's play at Tottenham is 76,000 per week. It's also worth noting that Daniel Levy received a £3 million sterling bonus for the stadium completion last year. I just find this absolutely ethically, morally, and even from a PR standpoint, it's just disgusting what Spurs are doing. And I think that the little nugget in the middle of Dan Roan's reporting about Spurs, a Premier League club with such massive turnover and resources, using the government, the UK government's furlough job retention scheme, which is not meant for massive clubs that can well afford to pay all their staff a proper and decent wage throughout this crisis. I mean, I'm just blown away by this. And I know they're not the only club that's operating this or that's going to look to operate this and look to cut the wages of their non-playing staff. But this is absolutely disgraceful.
Well, it's particularly ugly with them because you just see the palace that they built.
Right.
You know? So you know the kind of money that is coursing through the veins of that club. And so that's what makes it all the more disgusting to have to come to terms with. And I just hope that either there will be some sort of reversal in their decision when the PR kind of smacks them in the face, like what happened with the Sixers in the NBA in this country, or like you kind of hope that the players step up.
But hang on a second. I actually do believe that the players should step up too. And we've seen some clubs around Europe where the players have had to step in. But Andrew, we can't talk about the players before we're putting the cart before the horse here. Let's talk about
Joe Louis is a billionaire a few times over, and that's despicable.
And Tottenham itself is an entity that turns massive profits. This is just so wrong right now. And also to put pressure on a UK government that has to look after genuine small businesses to try and keep people and families afloat. It's absolutely disgraceful. But honestly, you know what? Part of the anger I feel right now, Andrew, is anger at myself. Why am I surprised by this? Think of the situation at the start of this season. And we've talked a few times before, probably not enough on this podcast, about the living wage. And what the living wage means in the United Kingdom is a wage by which non-playing staff at clubs, you know, it's enough per hour. It's a correct amount of money that by which they can live their lives with, and it's a take home pay that's worth it. Currently, I'm reading from an article from the start of this 2019-2020 season. Only four Premier League clubs are accredited with the Living Wage Foundation status. That's Liverpool, Chelsea, Everton, and West Ham. Those four clubs have formally committed to paying staff and third-party contractors at least £9 an hour, rising to £10.55 an hour for the two London clubs, because I think the London living wage is obviously, the cost of living in London is much higher. Like, why am I shocked at this? You know?
Yeah, no, you're right. You're like right.
The greed has gone through the roof. It's absolutely disgusting.
Well, I mean, I'm reading here that, Tottenham, I'm not trying to deflect here. But
Andrew, you are deflecting.
I'm not deflecting.
Like Hugo Lloris parrying a shot away.
Not deflecting. I just said how disgusting it is. But like Newcastle announced on Monday that they're putting certain members of non-playing staff on leave.
Oh, pathetic. Absolutely pathetic. I've heard rumblings come out of other clubs, including Bournemouth and Norwich. This is not acceptable. There is a moral duty to look after those staff that work for you, particularly in a crisis. But again, like I said, I'm angry at myself. Why, when everything was perfectly fine and they wouldn't, and they refused, and so many clubs are reluctant, it appears, to pay the living wage, why in a crisis would I expect these clubs, these massive, global, money-making rackets, to help anybody else out?
Sad. Very sad. And it's also sad that wasn't the only bad news pertaining to Spurs this week.
Well, let's couch this. This is different news. It's not the same, right?
No, but it was also not news that Tottenham fans read and were happy to see.
You can't be surprised. Do you want me to read the quotes from Sir Harold of Kane?
Sure.
So Harry Kane spoke to Jamie Redknapp on Instagram Live, which is now obviously the new media force, apart from our good selves on this podcast. I love Spurs. I always love Spurs, but I've said that if I don't feel we're progressing as a team or going in the right direction, I'm not someone to stay there for the sake of it. I'm an ambitious player. I want to improve, get better, and become one of the top, top players. You know he's talking to a redknapp if he's saying chop, chop player. It all depends on what happens as a team and how we progress as a team. So it's not a definite I'm going to stay there forever, but it's not a no either. So I suppose as a Tottenham man, Andrew, when you read quotes like that, I suppose you can shrug your shoulders in the current moment right now because nobody's going anywhere. But generally, how does that make you feel?
Nothing surprising about it because he kind of said this. Like he said before Mourinho, under Pochettino, when he's been asked about this, he said, if I'm not seeing upward trajectory, I'll consider all options. So like there's nothing surprising. Maybe this is a little bit more in your face and makes it, you know, sound a little bit more imminent. But I was not surprised when he saw this. Ultimately, you ask how I feel reading this. Ultimately, there is almost nothing that he could do at this point to kind of jeopardize the way that I feel about him.
Right.
Since he's emerged as one of Tottenham's greatest players of all time, I think you'd have to say.
Right.
I love Spurs, but I also understand that they're not Real Madrid and they're not Barcelona. And I understand what those clubs represent for a player like Harry Kane. And I understand that the window for a player to make a move to a club like that is very small, especially for him. He's going to be 27 in July. He's somebody who, you know, not so quietly, injuries are now playing a major role in his career.
Right.
So like the window, if he believes I've done all that I can do for this club, I've given all that I can give, I've experienced great moments, I believe that my legacy at Tottenham is in a place where it will be unhurt by a move to a club of the next level up. I wouldn't like it, obviously, but I get it. I wouldn't hate him for it. I hope all Tottenham fans understand that. I hope that he'll always be somebody who can come back to that club and receive ovations and be beloved forever. Now I will say there are certain clubs that if I were to see him go to, it would hurt. Like, you know, Manchester United would hurt. Seeing him go to like Inter, that might hurt.
Why would that hurt?
Well, like what titles are they guaranteed to win? Like what, you know, even this year when we thought they were going to make a run for Serie A, they fell off and like it's become.
Well, why would you care about that?
Well, all right. Compared to an EPL club, I would prefer him to leave the league altogether. Sure.
Right.
But I'm just saying, like, if we're talking about the stature of various clubs, like if he wants to leave Tottenham because he wants to go somewhere to win trophies, I don't know. What was the last trophy that Inter won?
What do you think of the stats guys who say he's possibly in decline anyway, and certainly the injuries have not helped and have eroded some of his qualities, and that maybe it's a good time for both. He's not going to get the move any later, and Spurs won't get the cash any later.
I know, and I feel like a hypocrite saying that I don't want him to leave. I mean, I think most Tottenham fans don't want him to leave, but it's like we can say that out of one side of our mouths, but on the other side of our mouth, we're ripping Daniel Levy for not having sold Eric Dier when his value was at 40 million. But had he sold Eric Dier when his value was at 40 million, what would we have been doing as Tottenham fans? Ripping Daniel Levy for selling him. Oh, this club has a chance to win a title. We're competing in the Champions League and you're going to go and sell our best defensive midfielder just for the money. Like, so it's not fair the way we treat these guys. And they know that. And I think that they accept that. So you're right. I get your point. And maybe it would be hard to stomach, but maybe in hindsight, we would look back on this moment and say it was a wise move to do it. Yeah, I don't know. I wouldn't fault him. I wouldn't fault him for doing it. And like the other thing too, you know, I've seen people talking about if his ambition is not to just win titles, but to go on and potentially challenge like Alan Shearer's record.
Right.
For goal scoring in the Premier League. Like he's still at a point. It's close right now. Like he's fading a little bit off the pace, but it's still within the realm of possibility. Like if that's something that he wants to try to achieve, is playing in a Jose Mourinho system the way to do that? Like Tottenham not going to be scoring many goals, it feels like, in the next year.
But Kane, not to cut across, Andrew,
yeah, yeah.
Kane as a center forward, that could become a lightning rod for how Mourinho's, the rest of his time at Spurs is shaped, because Mourinho is not going to want to let him go. He is kind of the center forward, although not entirely, but kind of the center forward he'd like to have. And if Kane goes, which I think is quite possible, it's then incumbent upon Spurs to replace him, and Mourinho will look to spend big in that position. And I wonder how willing Levy will be, knowing this, his spendthrift ways. Mourinho is going to want a big, expensive, established striker, and almost as close to a like for like in that position, which could cause problems. Can I also give you another quote from Kane?
Sure.
He's talking about working with Mourinho, and this one just stood out like a sore thumb. It's been good. What you see is what you get. He's an honest guy. If he likes you, he'll tell you. If he doesn't like you, he'll tell you. From my point of view, I've built a good relationship with him.
Yeah, that's an interesting one, because he's almost in a weird position having to answer that.
Because he hasn't really worked with him.
Well, not a ton. Now, we do know from comments that Jose Mourinho has made about Kane, we know Mourinho loves Harry Kane. But Kane is in a weird position having to answer that, because, like, how's he supposed to face Tanguy and Ndombele, who Mourinho just, like, can't bash enough? If Kane comes out and says, oh, I love him, he's the best, like, well, then what about, like, it's going to be hard as the leader of this club for you to then face your teammates that Mourinho just repeatedly bashes through the media. So, like, I don't know. I read that response from him about what he thinks of Mourinho, and I didn't really, it was a neutral response to me, which is about what I would have expected.
What else could he possibly say?
Yeah. But yeah, it'll be interesting to see what happens with him, because the window is kind of now if he's going to make this move. The last bit that I have to say on this, like I said, I wouldn't be upset. I would get it if he were to leave now. The only other part of me that would be maybe a tad bit upset is, for the most part, in the Kane era of Spurs, they've been contending for something, whether it be in a cup competition or contending for the league. This was really the first year where they were not contending for a single thing. So there's part of me that's like, I kind of wish, like, give them a chance, Harry, to make it right, to go out and maybe, like, have more time under this manager, to work with these players and that have been hurt, a healthy squad when they come back. Maybe he spends on guys that he wants, can really put his system into play. And then, like, give it one more go. Give the club one chance at least. Like, the first year that they're off the pace, you're gone. Like, they can't be afforded one year where things are a little bit off. Then you give them one more chance, and if they can't rebound, then I don't think anybody would fault you for leaving after that. Again, I get it if he leaves now. It makes sense to me, but my heart is for Spurs, and so that's like, part of me is going to be disappointed. I'd want him to at least give them one chance to make it right.
How utterly pointless are transfer rumors right now?
I know. Yeah, it's so.
Oh my God. I'm seeing articles about Jadon Sancho, articles about Dybala, all this kind of stuff. Oh my God, it's tedious at the best of times in an ordinary world. And now we're in this, dystopian reality of.
Along those lines, can I ask you a question that only just came to me? So I'm putting you totally on the spot here, but you mentioned Jadon Sancho. He just turned 20, right?
Hmm.
Who do you think right now, if everyone suddenly was just like on the open market, everyone was out there, who do you think would be the most expensive player in the world right now?
Kylian Mbappe, probably.
Okay.
I would think Mbappe. But Sancho would be right in there.
Because he'd be in the conversation.
The age profile, his goal scoring, and his ability to assist. This player right now is in a tremendous sweet spot. We're here in United. They're going to do whatever they can to get a hold of him. And that's going to be an interesting one, but I don't want to do transfer rumors right now, Andrew. Not when we've got new technology that can take us back to the past. I'm about to hit the flux capacitor, Andrew here, which is a word that I've borrowed from a famous film. I hope I'm not infringing on any copyright. So what I need you to do is just hold on and let me start it up. Are you ready?
Yeah, please.
Can you hear that? All right. Into the DeLorean, Matty. Okay, we have to reach a certain speed, Andrew. Here we go. We're nearly there.
Caught offside with Andrew Gunling and JJ Devaney.
Oh, yes! unbelievable, into the finals of the Confederations Cup. A week ago, we had written this team off for dead. The United States men, JJ, have upset the number one team in the world, the defending European champions, 2-0. It goes to our boys, I guess our boys in white today. Oh my God, I'm out of breath. An emergency podcast here, caught offside, semi-final recap from the Confederations Cup. What is up?
Andrew, I can't believe what we've just seen. I really can't. You think of how horrifically that group stage went for the US men's national team. Egypt game aside, this was an absolute, you know, we were heading towards disaster. It took a 6-goal swing for us to even get to this point. And now look what's happened. We've beaten the dominant team in world football in Bloemfontein. This is quite a moment, even though
you were on this podcast just last week demanding Bob Bradley be fired. I mean, it was disgusting. It was a bit much, but
calm down.
That's where you were at.
I asked questions about where this team was heading a year out from the World Cup in 2010. And, maybe some of those questions have been answered tonight.
Oh my goodness. So just to look at it, we'll go through this because my goodness, what a fun, fun day this has been watching this play out. It was, like we said, it wasn't just unexpected from where things were, a week ago in this tournament, but it was unexpected really before this game started, like today. I mean, Spain are Spain right now. And we don't really know what this U.S. team is, although I guess we're starting to learn something about them. It had been 35 games unbeaten for Spain. But that is the case no longer. And it's not just that it was 35 games unbeaten, but JJ, it also snapped when Jozy Altidore scored, in the 27th minute. It also snapped a streak of 451 scoreless minutes that Spain had held their opponents to, which is incredible in its own right. I guess we'll go through this, let's look at the goals first, because I'm sure those will be the moments that, really.
First of all, before we do the goals, where did you watch the game?
So I was actually down the Jersey Shore. I was in Avalon, New Jersey, taking it in there. It was a beautiful sunny day. It was not easy for me when the game ended to get in my car and drive the 3+ hours back to the Caught Offside Towers here. But you know what? For you, I'll do almost anything. So I left the beautiful beach, and now I'm here with you as we record this emergency podcast.
Yeah, I don't know if you were in a bar, if you could hear the commentary properly, but can we talk first about the first goal?
Yeah.
So I'm listening, and for anyone who didn't see the goal, Dempsey played the ball into Altidore on the edge of the box, and the teenager turned Captivia, who's his teammate at Villarreal. Now, okay, you can say Captivia didn't defend that well, whatever. He gets in a shot. Casillas could have done better. Okay, whatever. But one of the co-commentators with JP De La Camera, and I don't know who it was because I myself was in a bar watching the game, but I did hear above the din of the bar, the co-commentator said it was kind of a lucky ball to Altidore from Dempsey. And this enraged me. Andrew, it was such a good little ball. If you watch it again, he scooped it up to make sure it gets into the path of Jozy Altidore. Now, you can argue about the finish all you want, and I will. I still think that Casillas should do better. But at the same time, I think that was absolutely brilliant by Dempsey.
Oh, yeah. I would actually agree with you. I think it's, look, I'm going to give some of these guys the benefit of the doubt. And Clint Dempsey, I mean, I'm not just saying that jokingly. Clint Dempsey is a player that we've now come to know is, I think, of a level where we can say, like, I'll give him the benefit of the doubt when I see a great play like that. So, yeah, I mean, I get it. But, you know, I want to give Jozy credit, too. Like, he's – to show that strength, to body off, you know, a Spanish national team defender, and then have the composure to turn like that, get the shot on target. You're right, Casillas. When we know enough about Casillas, when he gets a hand on the ball, typically it's not going in. But Jozy was able to wrong foot him, and it's a great goal for him. One of the best, probably, of his career so far, if not the best.
And we should probably mention how well Charlie Davies played across this game. And particularly in the lead up to that goal. So my question for you was, watching this game, was let's accept that there's going to be Dempsey and Donovan playing underneath and wide of a preferred front two for Michael, for Bob Bradley. So are we now looking at Altidore and Davies as a partnership for next year?
Yes. I really think so. I think like these guys are so young, and I feel like their strengths complement each other perfectly. Like what you saw from Josie, who is more of like the hold up play, back to goal sort of player, and Davies, who's speed, quickness. I just feel like it's just like the perfect match. Like this is what you wait, you know, years for something like this to kind of happen upon a national team. Like you could go out for your club team and sign players who fit, you know, who fit a partnership like that, but to have it sort of like happen organically. And I think just like the energy that we saw Charlie Davies bring in the Egypt game, you know, once again tonight, he's running all over the place. He's making, I think, you know, barring anything unforeseen, I feel like you are looking at hopefully the U.S. strike partnership for years to come.
Now, there's something, and you know me, Andrew, I'm not a stats guy. I actually don't believe in them at all, but I'm going to read you some from this game. Because it is, you know, it's 2009. I got to get with the program. People are starting to look at statistics more. Look, if you look at the raw numbers, Spain had 29 attempts on goal, 8 on target. That's a lot. But the U.S. had 9 attempts, 2 on target, and they scored twice. But that's not the stat that stood out to me. The stat that stood out to me was Spain, who, as we know, under Vicente del Bosque, absolutely dominate possession. They had 56% of the ball. The U.S. had 44.
You're right. Amazing stat.
Yeah, that's an amazing stat to me. And if we talk about the second goal as well, the second goal to me is the DNA of this team, Andrew. Spain are in possession and the U.S. are not giving them a second. Not a second on the ball. They're pushing them. They're harassing them. And it's a turnover and some neat play that ends up at the feet of Landon Donovan, who puts in a low cross. Now, should our dear, dear friend Sergio Ramos have done better at the far post? Absolutely. He should have cleared that. I don't know what he was doing. Yeah. But at the same time, is that not what this team is about?
Well, you're so right. And it's what I wanted to bring up, because my whole thing about the second goal, 74th minute, it's Dempsey who's going to go down as the hero, but all the work was really done before the ball ever got to Clint. Because yes, the turnover in a dangerous spot on the field, Michael Bradley pressuring the ball, wins back possession for the U.S. And then can we talk about Benny Failhaber, how he makes this play happen? Like he comes in as a sub in this game and just like, he's just like this midfield maestro who gets on possession there. Props to him for not making what was probably the more predictable pass to Josie Altidore. It's probably a tougher pass, but you see your striker in a position where he might be in space. A lot of guys make that pass. I don't think it was there, and I think Josie Altidore might have been offside. And Failhaber holds up his run. Landon Donovan reads it beautifully, holds up his run so he doesn't go offside. Failhaber finds him, and then Donovan, like you say, it's not often that not just Sergio Ramos will make a mistake, but Gerard Piqué also kind of like back heels that ball back into play.
Right.
So it's not often that you'll see those two guys in particular make mistakes on the same play to lead to an opponent goal. But like give Donovan, give the U.S. credit. Like so they say, luck is the residue of design. Donovan plays in a ball that's making Spanish defenders uncomfortable. And I don't know if Sergio Ramos just lost track of where Dempsey was and thought he had more time, or if it was just a flat out error altogether. But like Clint Dempsey scored the huge goal against Egypt. Now he's doing it against Spain. Like this guy just, we're finding out his DNA right now. Like we've known for a while that Clint Dempsey is legit. But like we are seeing the DNA of this player. He scores big goals. He is there when you need him. And once again today, it was the goal that put it away. It felt like, you know, Spain pressured a little bit, for the rest of that game, but like that was the one that did it. And just, you're right. The DNA of the team, props to them, man, because like the build up to that goal is what you want this team to be.
But isn't it great that you can say you've got that ball willing ability in the middle of the park with Michael Bradley, and you can augment that with someone who is like this silky number 10 and Benny Failhaber. Let's be honest. As we sit here right now, Andrew, he's going to have a long and illustrious U.S. men's national team career.
Definitely.
I don't think there's any clouds on the horizon for this guy.
No, scored the Gold Cup goal. Came in off the bench against Spain today, showed no fear. Yes. Couldn't agree.
I mean, I'm not saying he's going to start every game because it is tight up there with what that potential front four or front five or front three could look like, however Bob Bradley wants to put it together. But to have someone like Phil Harbour, Andrew, I think in years to come, we're going to be talking about him as one of the true greats of the U.S. men's national team.
Yeah. Now, there's another element of this. We're talking about the Altidore goal, talking about the Dempsey goal. But I don't even know if I'm talking about like handing out a man of the match. First of all, it's the defending, I think, for me. Just the continued ability, like you talked about the relentlessness in the middle of the park. Yes, that was true. But there was also just this like continued repelling of Spanish attack, from especially Aguchi Onyewu, who, if I had to give out a man of the match, it might be him. Jay DeMeritt also in central defense. But like Carlos Bocanegra hasn't played left back for the U.S. in like 2 years. They put him out there against the number one team in the world, and he holds his own. He played very well. You know, Jonathan Spector on the other side at fullback. Like, you look at those four guys, and you know, we're talking about if the U.S. has found their pairing up at the top with Josie and Charlie Davies. I look at the back and say, if this is our back four for, like, through next year's World Cup, I feel good heading into 2010 with these guys.
I totally accept what you're saying there. The thing about Onyewu that you hope is he's had such a good time in Belgium. You hope that he goes to maybe even a higher level and kind of solidifies there, goes to a team and has that same kind of run that he's had at Standard Liège. I will say this though, Andrew. Mm-hmm. My key moment in the game was not Onyewu's constant interventions. By the way, how many crosses did he clear?
It was nonstop.
It was incredible. And against the European champions. But my key moment and my key player, me being a Liverpool fan right now, maybe I shouldn't be saying this, but just before halftime, Tim Howard saving with his foot to deny Fernando Torres an equalizer. Had they gone in at the break at 1-1 in this game, I would have been hugely concerned for them. Yeah. And it's big saves like that. Look, we're not going to be a team that's not going to give up chances throughout the 90 minutes against the really elite sides like Spain. So we're going to need the goalkeeper to come up big. And Tim Howard, yet again, man.
Yeah, clean sheet. Can't ask for much more than that. I mean, we were saying at the start of this podcast, when you just think, like, think of where we were and the things that we were saying after the first two group stage matches.
Right.
And look, like, it's funny. You look back on it with different perspective. Now, in the moment, you're furious. I look at it now, I'm like, well, Brazil and Italy, I don't know that I expect us to win. Now, the U.S. may have a chance. Brazil and South Africa, of course, are going to play their semifinal tomorrow. Even though South Africa are the home team, it's carried them this far. I think one more may be a bridge too far for them. I think Brazil will go through, and the U.S. will have their chance. They've seen them once, and just the way they're playing now, it feels like Brazil are going to be facing a different team. So who knows? Who knows at this point?
Can I ask you a question? And it's not necessarily game related, but it's more something that we've been noticing throughout this Confederations Cup in 2009.
Yeah.
That droning noise in the background.
I'm so glad you brought this up.
I mean, are we going to have that next summer as well?
No, we can't. I'm sure. I've been reading about it. I guess it's called a vuvuzela, and it's. Like, I don't want to rain on the parade of like a tradition of this country. That feels wrong to do. But strictly, like, as a viewer watching this, it cannot be the soundtrack of next summer's World Cup. It just can't be. Like, so much of the sport is the crowd and the atmosphere and the singing, and like you can't hear anything above it. Like, I know that they like. I guess it's fun if you're in the stadium and you've got one of these things and you can like play it throughout the game. But like, I'm just talking strictly as a viewer. I don't want the 2010 World Cup soundtrack to sound like a nest of bees.
I know we've got Sunday's final coming up and we're really excited about that. But can we just project forward? We should be very confident going into next summer's World Cup.
Yes. Yeah. And look, I mean, it's almost not a fair moment to ask that question. The U.S. just achieved.
I know.
One of the greatest wins in the history.
I'm a Euro snob, Andrew. And as good as the Confederations Cup is, it's not the real dance for me. Okay. So.
No, you're right. But I mean, look at the team Spain put out there. Are you telling me that they're not taking this seriously? Like, that was Spain. You know, look, every team in this tournament is playing like as though this means something to them. So I get what you're saying, but
let's look at the team they put out. It is not, I mean, I had to read it back to myself several times to really fully drink in what the US did in this victory tonight. Casillas in goal, Piqué, Puyol, David Villa, Xavi, Torres, Fabregas, Capdevila, Alonso, Ramos, and the only outlier here is Albert Riera. But even still, he's playing at Liverpool.
So. I mean, come on, man. Like, that team is ridiculous.
Yeah.
You know what? These guys, they should be so proud of themselves the way they went out there. No fear. 1 through 11, that entire lineup tonight. Props to Bob Bradley. Because, like we said, he was taking it from people leading up to that Egypt game. And so, like, he rallied this team.
And I think a good performance in the final, and I don't want to downplay it. It would be great to win, but a good performance in the final, and I think Bob Bradley will be coming out of this tournament in a totally different light for a lot of US soccer fans.
Yeah. Oh my gosh, what an incredibly, incredibly fun experience this game was. I guess before I say goodbye, I guess I'll just say to you that we'll be back here, win or lose, after the final. The final. They're into a final, U.S., in a FIFA final of some kind. Like, this is a bit uncharted territory. I know it's the Confederations Cup. I'm allowed to be excited, though. We just beat Spain.
Good times, man. It's absolutely incredible.
Well, hey, this was
We seem to be shorting. We're shorting. We've run out energy, Andrew. We're going back to the future. We're going back to the future right now.
Well, hold on.
No copyright infringement was meant by any of my comments. We're back.
Oh my God.
Wow. That was crazy.
What a riveting, riveting experience traveling through time in the way that we have to that moment. Oh, what a fun day. I'm so glad we were able to relive that.
That's fantastic, Andrew. And we'll be doing more of these low-tech traveling back in time scenarios. Keep them coming in. We're getting some really good ones. There's a lot of people, Andrew, who want the French World Cup, the Italian win in Germany over the French with the Zidane headbutt, the penalties, everything. They want all that.
What an incredibly memorable day. And it was a day that occurred before this podcast existed. So you know what? If that's where the time machine takes us next week, I'm good with that.
Can I mention something that's, it's not uniquely New York, unique New York, but it is something that you can't go to a pizzeria in Bensonhurst. You can't go to a pizzeria in many places in Long Island, and you cannot go to a pizzeria in Staten Island, fact, without behind the wall of, or on the wall of that pizzeria, somewhere within the environs of that pizzeria, by law, there must be a picture of Fabio Cannavaro lifting the World Cup in 2006. Have you ever noticed that?
Actually, I don't know that I've noticed that.
I guarantee you.
I don't spend much time, though, in Brooklyn and Staten Island.
Apparently, Staten Island in 2006 for the World Cup was absolutely ridiculous. The whole Italian-American community just kind of coalesced behind this team. Even guys who weren't really soccer fans. In fact, I dare you, actually I don't dare you to do this, this would be a home invasion, but I would challenge anyone to try and go to an Italian house in Staten Island who had maybe guys of a certain age between 12 and 26 around that time who did not buy an Italian jersey, a Puma Italian jersey at that time. It just, you talk to anyone, I wasn't in the country at the time, but there's so many pizzerias I've been in, and the first thing I look for is Fabio Cannavaro lifting the cup.
I'm curious who most Italian fans view, like, from that era as their favorite player. Is it Buffon? Is it, like...
Buffon, Del Piero had this renaissance.
Uh-huh.
Fabio Grasso, think of what he did. He was elevated from nowhere.
All against Germany, yeah.
Who else would there be in that mix there? A lot of people still like Materazzi because he was such a rogue. Cannavaro was World Player of the Year that year. Incredible. Buffon. Who else would have been in that side that really
I wonder if some of those Juventus players.
Gattuso.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Some of those Juventus players, I wonder in the aftermath, with the scandal that like a lot of them were attached to, I wonder if that took some of the shine off for some Italian fans.
I don't think.
Like if you were an Italian fan who supported AC Milan in that time, like, okay, you might have loved Cannavaro during that World Cup, but then when that scandal unfolded, I wonder if it kind of changed the way some Italian fans viewed some of those Juve players.
I'm not so sure really, Andrew. I think there was an ability amongst Italian fans to coalesce behind that team and kind of put the club stuff aside. I mean, it would need to be.
Yeah, compartmentalize. It's very important. Very
fan, important. If you're a sports fan, you have to be able to do it.
Amazingly, you actually compiled the rundown this week and you have a what to watch for. And it has actual games.
Yes, a what to watch for. For a long time, Andrew, people have been living off the Hyundai Australian A-League, but now that's all those games, their games have been postponed as well. So we turn to the Belarusian Premier League, which will not stop playing.
Right. So, it's, I believe, FC Alexander Hleb going up against Alexander Hleb United.
Andrew, how disrespectful you are to the proud nation of Belarus.
So nothing about their nation, just probably their most prominent player.
So the season is only just beginning there, and both Bate Borisov and Dinamo Minsk, who would be the two well-known teams, they're looking to get a win on the board after losing their opening two games. So this is this weekend's slate of important games in the Belarusian Premier League. We've got Belchina versus Gordiea at 10 a.m. US time on Friday. Also on Friday at 12 p.m., you can watch it straight after, Dinamo Minsk and Torpedo Belazodino.
Torpedo. And by the way, when you say you can watch it straight after, what network will I be able to find these on?
There are streams that you will be able to find online, I'm sure. And I believe the Belarusian League have done TV deals with countries like Israel to try and show games. That's what I've been hearing. Shakhtar will play Niemen on Saturday at 8:30 a.m., while the aforementioned Bate Borisov will play Rue Brest, on Saturday at 10:30 a.m. So that's this weekend's slate of games. By the way, while we're on the Belarusian Premier League, there's a lot of people in power in football around the world who are urging them not to be playing games right now.
Yeah.
And this is from Marca. The nation's president, Alexander Lukashenko, has been giving his citizens some very particular advice to fight off the coronavirus disease, including washing hands with the country's favorite drink, vodka. This is a quote from Lukashenko. "You shouldn't just wash your hands with vodka," the president said, "but you should at least drink 40 or 50 milliliters each day and go to the sauna two or three times a week. The president also suggested that tractors might also have healing properties. "There are people working with the tractors and nobody talks about the virus. The tractors will heal them because the fields heal everything." By the way, this advice is being the sole advice of Lukashenko and not of Caught Offside or any medical experts. The tractors will not heal anything. But this is the kind of stuff that's coming out of Belarus at the moment. Although the cases in Belarus, I read today, have reached 100 of coronavirus. So, yeah.
I would be worried.
What a weird scenario, right?
Yes. Let's see. We continue.
We don't continue with anything, Andrew. We have a classic rewatch of the week. So I'm trying to find games online that people can watch and that are absolute epics. So I'm picking Newcastle versus Liverpool, or rather Liverpool versus Newcastle. 3rd of April, 1996. I will post the link on our Instagram and our Twitter feeds. This is the famous season where Newcastle blew the 12-point lead, and we had the emotional Kevin Keegan attacking Alex Ferguson on TV, saying, "I would just love it if we beat them, love it." And the huge collapse. No team had collapsed in the modern era from such a huge top-flight lead. And, this game was amazing. 4-3 it finished, and it is just worth every minute of it. If you were selling the Premier League in a package of games, Andrew, this game would be in amongst it.
I look forward to that. Let's see now. Amazingly, hasn't been a match in weeks, and yet this is going to be one of the longest podcasts I think we ever do, because we still have a mailbag to get to.
Yeah, but I don't care if it's going long, Andrew, because you know what? We're giving people content over these long hours in quarantine. We are performing service, and thank you to everyone who's thanked us. And in some cases, you guys are the heroes, not us. We merely do a podcast and Twitter on about.
Did anyone suggest that we were the heroes?
Not heroes per se, but I'd like to frame it that way. Raymond Orozco kicks us off with a pretty good question, Andrew. Who are your guys' favorite player? So your favorite player, in your opinion, your greatest player, and the player, in your opinion, that was the most overrated of all time.
Jeez.
Can I do this quickly? Can I do my first two quickly? Because I think the favorite player and the greatest player are, they're not easy because there's been so many amazing players over my lifetime, but I would go with Zinedine Zidane as my favorite player.
Really?
Yeah,
I've never heard you. Oh, I read this question wrong. I thought it was our personal. Oh, well, he's my answer. No,
I mean, club wise, I could go Suarez or Steven Gerrard or someone like that. But honestly, my favorite player was Zinedine Zidane. And in my opinion, the greatest player has been Lionel Messi. Now, here comes the overrated part. I think Beckham, after he left United, was so massively overrated. It's unbelievable. You know another guy who did nothing for me, Andrew? Famous Brazilian fullback Roberto Carlos. This is going to get people very angry. Yeah, I thought he was wildly overrated, and even though he played in a Galacticos Madrid side, he won a World Cup. Not for me. Just never did it for me as a player. I thought he was so self-indulgent, and of recent times, and I'm sure I'm missing out on some. Joe Hart, even in the era where he's number one for Manchester City and number one for England, I thought he was so wildly overrated as to be unbelievable.
Let's see. For my favorite player, I guess this is actually hard. I want to say Clint Dempsey, him, Kane, Lennon. Aaron Lennon, because I didn't read the question the same way you did. Favorite player to watch. I just thought he meant our favorite player. Greatest player, I agree with you. Well, no. Zidane, he's your favorite player?
Yeah.
Until this moment, I've never heard you mention that.
I mean, I've mentioned him. I've mentioned Rui Costa. Oh, yeah. It's not all about Liverpool players, Andrew.
You're such a liar. I don't know how you live with yourself. You were right. Greatest player for me is also Lionel Messi. Boy, I feel terrible, but I'm having a really hard time thinking of my most overrated player. I'm trying to think of like your Joe Hart one is good because I was trying to think of goalkeepers who maybe weren't asked to do a ton because they have like a great defense in front of them.
Right.
I'm just trying to think of who that is without making an utter fool of myself.
Some people, and I don't know how many French listeners we have, but some people used to think that Fabien Barthez was wildly overrated, and the fact that he had the brilliant defenders like Thuram in front of him and Laurent Blanc, guys like that, that kind of covered him a bit. I'm not sure about that. I mean, he didn't have a good time when he went to United, which was probably the biggest club move of his career.
Can I think on it? Can we continue this and I'll keep thinking about it and I'll shout out if I think of one that I like more than the ones that you did?
Sure, absolutely. Nathan Nazarino, Nazerno. Nathan contacted us. And I think this was one of my favorite ones from the mailbag this week that wasn't related to us trying to do a emergency pod. Dear Andrew and JJ, listener since 2017, love the pod as always. I recently stumbled upon a highlight of the Manchester United versus AC Milan 06-07 Champions League semi-final tie. It really opened my eyes to the brilliance of Kaká, especially his first two goals in the first leg at Old Trafford. As a relatively new football fan who only started following around 3 years ago, can you talk about his game and his legacy? How do you think his individual career would have gone had Messi or Ronaldo not existed? And was his time at Madrid a big disappointment? Lots of my friends say so. So first of all,
that last part, yes, it was a big disappointment.
It was a huge disappointment. First of all, about that game in particular, you can get that really extended highlights on YouTube. You're right about that game and those goals. Just to remind people, the first one was a brilliant finish from a tight angle. He just burns by Gabriel Heinze and side foots past Edwin van der Sar from a tough angle. And the second is even better. He runs onto a ball down the left-hand channel, flicks it over Gabby Heinze, sees Evra coming across, nips in between the two players to just head it on, the two players, it was like Keystone Cops. They crash into each other. He runs around the far side and side foots home so coolly past Van der Sar. Amazing. So I hate to be reductive about it, but the first thing to say is he was never as good as Messi or Ronaldo, never as physical a specimen as Ronaldo. But a good finisher and not as skillful as Messi, but still an excellent player. And really, it was injuries that scuppered him. He spoke to, Sport TV, in 2018. So not so long ago. They're a Brazilian channel, and he was asked about his time at Madrid, which pretty much finished him as a top class player. The problem at Madrid was consistency. At the beginning, it was because of constant injuries. I had a problem with my hip in the first season. I pushed myself so that I could be at the World Cup, but suffered a groin injury. I underwent treatment in Curitiba just before the 2010 World Cup. After the tournament, I had surgery on my knee and was out for 6 months. And then when I returned, I had Mourinho. My main problem at Madrid was a lack of consistency, firstly due to injuries and then because of the coach. I spent 3 years trying to convince Mourinho to give me a chance, but I was powerless and he was the one making decisions. What I tried to do was be a model professional. Now I can go back to Madrid knowing that the doors are always open for me. Florentino Perez said that I was one of the most professional players he'd known at the club. I mean, to have a hip injury that young and then to have a problem with the knee. And I'm sure at the time he was under tremendous pressure to be fit for that World Cup. And Andrew, what is your abiding image of him at Orlando?
Unfortunately, he was hurt for so much of it.
Yeah.
I mean, they never reached anywhere near the levels of success I think people had hoped they would once he announced he was going to be going there.
No, not really at all.
In postseason, so.
Yeah. Sorry to cut across you.
No, it's all right.
My abiding image was him coming off as, I don't think he even played again, coming off at the new stadium. Was it the first game in the new stadium or one of the opening games in the new stadium, coming off injured, and he just looked so forlorn. Yeah. Sometimes it's just injuries. Emmanuel in Washington, D.C., I just wanted to say thank you for still doing a podcast with everything going on. Here's an interesting one. Emmanuel started listening to the pod last year. I'm a relatively new soccer fan and have been a Manchester United fan for about 5 years. Oh my God, what a time to become a United fan. I started listening to you guys so my soccer knowledge and love across all leagues could grow, and I've got that and much more. I'm a medical professional, and hearing you guys pod is something to look forward to and brings a great laugh. Thanks for all you do. No, thank you for all you do,
yeah.
Emmanuel. I don't know what side of the medical profession you're on, but thank you for what you do. I just wanted to dwell on that, though. Imagine becoming a United fan. So 5 years ago, around 2013, 2014.
Well, it's brutal. It's particularly brutal because from your friends, you take all the shtick of being a bandwagon front-running fan without any of the benefit of that team actually winning, you know?
Yeah. I mean, you've got none of the bonuses of being a fan of the biggest club in the world, and yet you have to take all the abuse and banter that they've taken for the last few years.
Yeah.
So let me just move on here finally to – oh, that's the end of the mailbag.
Oh, all right. At CO Soccer Pod on Twitter, caughtoffsidepod@gmail.com, and caughtoffsideespn on Instagram. I was thinking more about my most overrated player. Unfortunately, the player that I would have chosen, I feel like the cat is out of the bag. Like I would have said before the season, remember when Arsenal signed David Luiz? People were excited about it. Like there was this idea of, okay, Arsenal needed a central defender. So they went out and they got one. And I remember saying on the podcast, I don't think much of him. So I'm not going to pretend like I think much of that signing. And I think that has bore itself out this season. So he would have been mine, but I don't know if you can say he's overrated anymore because people, I think, don't really think he's that great a player. Let's see now. Red card.
This is so low grade. Oh my God.
JJ, I went with a little simmering French feud. Hardly.
Oh.
Yeah. Benzema versus Giroud. During an Instagram Q&A, with Karim Benzema, somehow Olivier Giroud's name came up and Benzema had this to say about him. He said, "You can't confuse a Formula One car with a go-kart, and I'm being kind. I know I'm a Formula One car. It works because he, Giroud, is there. That's it. it's not going to be spectacular. He then continued, though, and he said, Griezmann, Mbappe, they get seen more while he, Giroud, rolls his sleeves up and does the dirty work. But does everyone like his game? I don't know. This is a feud that is kind of confusing to me.
And unnecessary.
Well, obviously it's unnecessary. I guess I give him credit if he... We rip these guys when they lie to our faces and just give stock answers. He's actually being like weirdly honest in a time where I don't know if anybody even really wants it. But like, it's super condescending, but he, like, is he trying to cover his tracks? Like he says, okay, I'm a Formula One car, incredibly arrogant, and he's a go-kart, incredibly condescending. But then he says that Giroud is the guy who does the dirty work and doesn't really get the accolades. Like, that's almost complimentary. So I don't know. I don't know what he's trying to do here. It's weird, though, and I think in the end it is insulting.
The timing is bizarre as well. Very, very strange.
Now, did you see Olivier Giroud's comeback?
No,
because really, this is like you talk about like a mic drop. Giroud said this to Bfoot. He said, "People say you cannot compare a Formula One car with a go kart, and the only thing I can say on the matter is that I'm a world champion." So. That isn't bad for a go-kart. Bang. Got him.
Yeah, it's not that
kind of viewed as like the weak link of that team. And he was kind of mocked during the tournament a little bit for his inability to score. But he was the starting center forward for a World Cup winning team.
Yeah, that's so right.
Have that.
And he joins kind of the annals of, Stefan Givarsh and guys like that who have World Cup winners medals, but never really did a lot from the center forward position for France. By the way, I hope that comeback sounds better in the native French. Cause yeah, not bad for a go-kart. Zing. Wow.
Yeah. What do you have?
My red card goes to Jack Grealish. And this is from the Irish Independent. Jack Grealish says he's deeply embarrassed by an incident this week involving a house party and a car crash. And the former Ireland under 21 star has apologized for his actions. Photos emerged on Monday of a Range Rover owned by Grealish in the aftermath of an early morning collision involving three other vehicles after a house party in Solihull, and West Midlands police confirmed they were investigating the matter. The photos were made public online 24 hours after Grealish had issued an appeal via video message on his Twitter account for fans to stay indoors and observe government guidelines on combating COVID-19. "I am deeply embarrassed about what's happened this weekend," he said in a second video issued on Monday evening. "I know it's a tough time for everyone at the moment being locked in. I got a call from a friend asking to go around to his and I stupidly agreed to do so. I don't want anyone to make the same mistake I did. I urge everyone to stay at home and follow the rules and guidelines. I know for a fact that's what I will be doing in the future. I hope everyone can accept my apology and we can move on from this." Aston Villa had a statement. "Aston Villa is deeply disappointed that one of our players ignored the government's guidance on staying at home during the coronavirus crisis. Club captain Jack Grealish has accepted that his decision to leave his house was wrong and entirely unnecessary." You'll notice out of both those statements, no mention of an early morning car crash with three other vehicles.
Yeah.
After a house party. Let's just sweep that under the carpet. Now, Grealish, we thought had become this mature player because after he had kind of ascended into the spotlight as a teenager at Villa in 2015 with the run to the FA Cup final and all that, that summer and the months after, he was kind of seen, you know, doing what young people do, experimenting with alcohol, falling asleep on the pavement in some Spanish resort, all those things. So we thought young Jack the Lad had moved on somewhat from this kind of thing. But here we are. Not yet. So that is a tale of one villain, Jack Grealish, red card. But also, I would like to say the worst thing, going to the house party is not a good idea. But, you know, potentially driving a car after being at a party, is that wise?
Nope. No, it is not. Man of the match. So mine, JJ.
We can't just get over your ad hoc sound effects. Good God. You are a master. You're like the guy who was it in Police Academy that could make all the noises.
Yeah. All that stuff. So this isn't like really a special man of the match necessarily, but I'm giving it to DeMarcus Beasley just because he did a thing on Twitter that I thought was cool and would be fun for us to talk about. DeMarcus Beasley went on and listed his all-time U.S. men's starting 11. He put himself out there and he went for it. So here's who he had. Try to follow me. Goalkeeper Tim Howard. And then in defense, he had Eddie Pope, Carlos Bocanegra, Marcelo Balboa, and Steve Cherundolo. In the midfield, I guess it's midfield. I don't know. It starts to get blurry. He's got himself, Claudio Reyna, Christian Pulisic. And then up front, he's got Landon Donovan, Clint Dempsey, and Jozy Altidore.
Huh.
So that's strong, but it's not mine. So I figured I would go compare his to what mine would be. Now the definites, like he has a few on there that I think are no doubt about it, have to be on the list. Like Dempsey and Donovan, no question about it. Claudio Reyna, no question about it.
Right.
I would say Eddie Pope, no question about it. And I would definitely say Steve Cherundolo, no question about it. He's the greatest fullback the U.S. has ever had. Now Dempsey or, DeMarcus did not have Tab Ramos in his midfield, who I would,
yeah, I would
no question about it.
Yeah, there's no question. Tab Ramos has to play.
Yeah. So that fills in 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 of the spots in net. God, I killed myself going back and forth between Tim Howard and Brad Friedel. Ultimately, I went with Timmy, kind of as the tiebreaker, just being the sheer number of World Cups that he was a part of. So that sort of was my tiebreaker. I did go with Oguchi Onyewu. I bounced Marcelo Balboa and I went with Onyewu in my midfield. Part of it.
Oh,
I know it's not fair, but here's the thing. I just think of, so he was 29. He was only 29 when he suffered that knee injury. So I just wonder how much of great Gooch we were robbed of from that knee injury. And I think of him pre that, what he did in Standard Liège, what he did for the U.S. I'm going to put him in there. And if you want to rip it, that's fine. I understand. But you know what? This is my list. You can make your own. Then it got hard for me because I don't know what we're doing with positions. I'll just give you up front in attack. I went with Donovan and Dempsey, and I bounced Jozy Altidore from DeMarcus Beasley's list, and I put Brian McBride in there.
McBride had played down the center, and
yeah,
you have Donovan and Dempsey either side.
Yeah, this is all kind of blurry. Or, I don't know, could Dempsey move back into the midfield? Because I also have Christian Pulisic on this team with, I mentioned Reyna and Tab Ramos. And I felt like, because I only have three real defenders, I felt like I should throw a true solid defensive midfielder on there. So I went with Jermaine Jones. And you might raise an eyebrow. Okay, you're right. But if you go through and try to find a better, pure defensive midfielder for the U.S., you might have a harder time than you think. So if I need that position, the hardest names to leave off were Balboa, who I just said, Brad Friedel, who I also said, John Harkes. I had a hard time leaving him off, but I just couldn't find the spot. DeMarcus Beasley was hard to leave off for the number of years he put in it all over the field for them. Kobe Jones, Alexi Lalas, Bocanegra, and they're thin at fullback. So even Fabian Johnson was tough for me to leave off. So I guess those guys would be on my bench, but
Can I make a suggestion? Instead of Jermaine Jones, I mean, Tom Dooley was just such an unbelievable player for the United. Like he must have at least 80, 85 caps, played in the center of the park, could win a tackle, could pass the ball, you know, kind of bridge that gap between the late 80s and the 90s and it, you know, brought that team forward. Also, Eric Winalda. I think we forget how good Eric Winalda actually was.
So tell me what attacker you're taking off for him.
Yeah, that's a good question. I'm going to go for a more skillful team. And I'm not saying he wasn't skillful, but a more skillful option. I'd take McBride out of the center and I'd put Dempsey down the middle with Donovan and Winalda either side.
By the way, and I didn't do this because I don't know if he's a true defensive midfielder, but like, I wonder if Jermaine Jones should be taken off for Michael Bradley.
I think Michael Bradley gets in ahead of Jones.
Okay.
Yeah, that's very interesting, Andrew. Very interesting. Yeah.
So thanks to DeMarcus Beasley for giving us some content.
Yeah, and let everyone send us to Axio Soccer Pod or Caught Offside ESPN. Try and get in contact and give us your your favorite U.S. men's national team 11 of all time, or the best, the best one.
It's almost sad that we did it like this, just as like, not a throwaway, but at the end of a long show, like that could have been an entire show during this time when there's no games going on.
Yeah, we can return to it. Okay.
No, this was it. This was it. It's over. We move on.
All right. My man of the match, villain part two, but a good guy in this case, Pepe Reina. Pepe Reina was talking to Corriere dello Sport, Andrew, about his nightmare contact with COVID-19. The Aston Villa goalkeeper has revealed he endured endless minutes of fear after contracting coronavirus symptoms that left him unable to breathe. The 37-year-old said he was on the mend after the worst moments of my life. Reina, on loan at Villa from Napoli, told Corriere dello Sport, "It is only now that I am winning the battle against coronavirus. He began to feel unwell nearly 2 weeks ago. I was very tired after experiencing the first symptoms of the virus," he said. "A fever, dry cough and a headache that never went away. It was just that constant feeling of tiredness. The most difficult moments was when I could no longer breathe. The 25 minutes I ran out of oxygen. It was the worst moments of my life. The only real fear I had was when I understood there was no oxygen. Endless minutes of fear, as if suddenly my throat had closed. As a result, I spent the first 6 or 8 days indoors." He said, "Staying at home at least was not a chore. I don't miss the company, as it's me, my wife, Yolanda, 5 children and 2 in-laws. The house is big and loneliness has no access to my home." Last week, when he first announced he suspected he had caught the virus, he said, "We are very privileged people. We have a big house with a garden. I think of the people who live in a 70 square meter apartment with 2 children. And for me, they are people who are showing a lot of strength." The Premier League has been suspended since the 13th of March. And Reina has previously said it was crazy not to have stopped the matches sooner.
Yeah.
I mean, that is just... it is just frightening. And I know the way the trends are going in terms of how dangerous it is for people who are immunosuppressed and people who are much older. And I understand that. But 37, that's the same age as me. It's really quite scary. And the symptoms that he had, I hate looking at it and thinking like, phew, I didn't get that. But I had pretty much everything he had except that terrible breathing issue. And I'm so glad of that.
Yeah, wow. It's really scary, man. And I'm glad that you are doing better.
Yeah, I definitely am. I'm monitoring my temperature every day. We're back into, the fever's gone. I don't have the aches and pains. I don't have that tiredness. I didn't tell you how after the podcast last week, Andrew, I literally just
crashed,
absolutely crashed. And I was so warm. I was like, I was wearing a t-shirt. I was sweating through it. It was bad, but obviously not as bad as what Pepe Reina had.
Yeah. Well, there you go.
Can I do a quick critics corner? It'll take 2 seconds.
You're incapable of doing a quick one. Last week was horrible.
No. This is quick. Andrew, guess what's back?
Ozark.
Well, in the same vein, not quite as druggy and killy and cartelly. Oh. In fact, not like that at all. Sunderland Till I Die has returned for season 2. So we catch up with them at the beginning of last season, not this season, the season beforehand. They've been relegated to League One. They have new ownership. So Ellis Short, the American, has left the club. He's also cleared all the club's debts, but they were on track to make between a loss of between 30 and 40 million each season. They have a new owner, Stuart Donald, and we take up life with them as they try to get the wage bill down to League One standards. They try to get rid of players like Lee Cattermole, who are on huge amounts of money, and they try to get back into the Championship. And we meet up with all the great supporters, and League One, Sunderland Till I Die. They have a new general manager, a new marketing manager who's quite interesting. And one of the things in the opening episode that they're trying to attack is the atmosphere in the Stadium of Light. And for a long time, they played classical music from Romeo and Juliet by Prokhorov as they came out the tunnel, and now they're looking to bring it more upbeat and more, I guess, more modern. And I watched the first episode. It looks really, really good. And like I said, the most interesting cases are not the Real Madrids or the Brazils or the Manchester Cities. It's the Sunderlands who've fallen from grace. So Sunderland Till I Die is back. Ration it out, folks. Don't inhale it in one setting, because the content is precious right now.
Yes, that is true. Well, hey, this content was precious. I hope all of you enjoyed this. I hope all of you stuck with it till the end, because this is going to break the record, I believe, for the longest one we've ever done.
Don't care. We're only doing one a week.
Yeah, that's, I understand. I understand all the entire situation. Hey, to you, I say.
Goodbye, Andrew.
No, that's not what you say.
Oh, I say, check you later, fun boy.
That's what you say. See ya.
Take care.
You've been listening to the Caught Offside Soccer Podcast.